Okay, everyone, good evening. Thank you so much for coming to the final part in this series on the problem of evil, and where we are going to be looking at what I think is the most interesting, the most fascinating response to the problem of evil, and that is the free will defense. And to kind of first kind of recap where we have been, to kind of recap the problem of evil, I'm going to straight away launch the source sheet. So hopefully everyone can see it. And just to remind ourselves of the philosophical problem of evil, it's a contradiction between two premises. The first of which is that there exists an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God. There is someone who is all powerful, all knowing, all good, and that God exists. And yet evil or bad things exist, which should be prevented by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God. So to use the example of now, 2 weeks ago and last week, when 2 weeks ago, the Tuesday before the very first year, I accidentally walked into one of those stone benches outside BIAV and hurt myself, a bad thing. God is omniscient. He knew I was about to walk into that bench. He is omnibenevolent. He's all good. He doesn't want me to be hurt. And he is omnipotent. He has the power to somehow or another prevent me from walking into that bench. And yet he didn't. I still walked into that bench, and therefore the only conclusion has to be, says the problem of evil, that this, as we know, bad things happen. This omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent deity cannot actually exist, and thus the philosophical problem of evil is essentially a theological claim for the non-existence of God. And so in the first week, we looked at the perhaps the best known response to the problem of evil, what are termed theodicies, which essentially challenge the fact that evil actually exists. No, it's not actually evil, it's justice. God is punishing those who deserve it, or alternatively, God is somehow rewarding the righteous by punishing them in this world so they will not be punished in the next. Classic theodicies essentially say what we believe to be evil is not actually evil. Last week, we looked at two other fascinating types of responses, the first of which essentially are what are called anti-theodicies. And basically, you accept that an omniscient, omnibenevolent, and omnipotent God exists. And yet you also accept evil exists, and yet you refuse to believe that one means the other does not exist. You kind of just hold, we saw examples, you basically hold your hands up. I don't know the answer. There must be an answer out there, but I don't know what it is. It's a mystery. Who knows? The other type of answers we looked at last week are non-traditional responses. And as I pointed out, it's a defense as opposed to an unequivocal answer. A defense only needs to, much as a defense lawyer in court, does not need to necessarily prove that the person he is defending did not commit the crime. The defense lawyer just needs to cast enough doubt in the minds of the jury that the person might not have committed the crime. So too, the defense, the non-traditional defense, and what we will see tonight, the free will defense, don't have to unequivocally prove that the problem of evil is wrong. It just needs to cast doubt upon its certainty. Non-traditional responses call into question, redefine what we mean by God's omnipotence and his omniscience. We're actually going to be once again returning to the same point about omniscience as we made last week, so we'll recap it then when we get to it. But essentially, even though we think God's omniscience means he sees everything that's about to happen, that's not necessarily true. You could argue God's omniscience does not mean God can actually see what's about to happen. You can argue God's omnipotence does not actually mean he has the power to completely withhold evil from this world. Those are all the responses we've seen thus far. Tonight, we are going to take a look at the most fascinating of the responses, the free will defense. And it's fascinating in its own right as a solution to the problem of evil. It also means we are very soon going to be opening the free will Pandora's box, and we're going to be somewhat touching on some of the issues surrounding questions of free will. What I'll say now, and I might find myself saying it later also, just as the problem of evil is this actually very lengthy theological challenge that, you know, we've spent cumulatively now, we will have spent multiple hours exploring. Free will is basically the same thing. And free will, we're essentially nesting within the problem of evil. But as we are going to see, there are a lot of major questions to ask about free will. We're going to scratch the surface. because we're using free will in order to defend the problem of evil. But we get to talk about some really, really interesting concepts of free will at the same time. And the free will defense in its simplest form, and we're going to start with its simplest form, and then we'll move to a more technically correct version later. But to start with the free will defense, if you take a look at the source sheet, you can see I put a source number one. The free will defense says, yes, it's true. If you take a look back at the problem of evil in the box, an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God exists. Yes, it's true. The second premise, evil or bad things exist. That an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God, you know, should stop. But take a look at source number one. There is a third premise. God places the value of free will above all other considerations, and then don't attach too much significance to the parentheses barring extenuating circumstances, but essentially the free will defense inserts into the problem of evil the concept of free will. In order to explain why this is a defense, first we'll use my bench hitting example and then a better example. So God could have stopped me. What the free will defense says is God could have stopped me from walking into that bench now over like 3 weeks ago. I'm still not over it. He could have stopped me from doing it. But if God suddenly acts like my puppeteer, then I don't actually have free will. There is a greater good, and that is free will. My ability to make my own choices and face the consequences. I chose to look at my phone as I was walking back into the shul building, and that's why I was distracted. If God stopped me from doing that, I would no longer have free will. And thus it's in God's interests, God's interest and our interests, for there to be free will, and thus for him not to always intervene in situations where evil or bad things exist. To use maybe a better example, God forbid, you know, someone breaks into your house. Again, that's an example of evil. It's an example of evil that an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent deity should stop. But if God were to stop the thief from going into your house, that would override this thief's free will. The thief's ability to make choices, the thief's ability to make decisions, to decide whether or not to do right or wrong. And so for that reason, God allows, God steps back and allows instances of evil to go unchecked. And already you may have several questions. And while I'm happy for people to ask questions, as I said before, this is the weaker version of the free will defense. We'll come to a slightly stronger one a little bit later, because already, even as I say this, I'm starting to ask myself questions in my head that I know will be answered later. But God will allow evil to go unchecked, bad things to happen in this world in order to preserve the greater good of free will. Why do bad things happen to good people? The free will defense essentially is, well, would you like to live in a world where there was strict divine justice at all moments? You wouldn't want it to be that you forgot to make a bracha on your food and then you take a bite into your lunch and a lightning bolt, you know, rains down and smacks you in the face. You want free will. Free will is actually good. And essentially, as humans, we have to therefore accept that, you know, we can't eat our cake and have it too. We can't be in a situation where we are only losing our free will in order to prevent bad things, because we're still losing our free will. And we don't want to lose our free will. That is, in a nutshell, the free will defense. Already, there are three issues of varying levels of challenge that have to now be addressed. The first is, how is this not a theodicy? Essentially, theodicies say that bad things happen to you because you are being punished, or because you are being, you know, punished in this world, not because you did anything bad, but so you'll be rewarded in the world to come. And now this, essentially, the free will defense is saying, well, now the reason you're facing evil is because you want to have free will. it seems to once again explain evil away as merely a byproduct of free will. That's just kind of, it's the other side of the coin. So there is, in a certain sense, it does have that theodic tone to it. But I think this is also where it's an opportunity to talk once more, ever so slightly, about theodicies and why the free will defense is not as explicit a theodicy. Because theodicies ultimately come from the idea that, you know, you don't even scratch your finger in heaven without God ordaining it. And specifically, theodicies believe that the reason evil has happened is because of you. The reason this specific thing, the reason I walked into that bench was because of something I did. It's all focused on the individual. In contrast, the free will defense has nothing really to say about me and everything to say about humanity as a whole. And this, I actually think, as I was thinking about this today, yesterday, whenever I was thinking about this, something else that emerges from theodicies is there is a certain level of spiritual arrogance that we can accidentally fall into if we believe that cataclysmic events are happening either because of our sins or are prevented because of our virtues. I think that obviously while the Torah talks a lot about reward and punishment, it's often much more in the collective. The people as a whole sin, and therefore the people as a whole suffer. But it's not, oh, you, because you forgot to make your bracha on lunch this morning, the whole town's going to lose power. That doesn't make sense. Who could imagine that they themselves are so important that their single action, irrespective of everyone else's actions, are going to influence the world? That's a theodicy. That's a theodic approach. The free will defense doesn't go that far. It's simply that people as a whole, humanity as a whole, cannot live in a world without free will. And therefore, because of it, from time to time, we must be casualties. And that, I think, is in a nutshell, the difference between a theodicy and the free will defense. Yes, to a certain extent, the free will defense is still, it's still acknowledging the existence of evil. It's not actually denying evil is evil, but it's explaining it away in a way that is good for the, in a way that causes a greater good for the entirety of humanity. There are bigger issues, however, with the free will defense. And the most important of all of them, and this is where we start to have almost philosophical inception, because now we have to open a whole different Pandora's box of Jewish philosophy, which is the fact that this third premise that we've now added to the problem of evil seems to be in direct confrontation with the first premise. Because the first premise declares God is omniscient. God knows everything that is going to happen. And yet the third premise says we have free will. And this is one of the most major philosophical questions, one of the most classic questions, you know, ever posed. How can we have free will if God knows what we are going to do? It's the free will versus determinism. If already all of our actions have been foreseen. So tonight, I'm drinking a bottle of water. The funny thing was, I wanted to make sure I use this example. So I wrote down in my notes, I was going to have a caffeine-free diet Pepsi. Because earlier today, I was planning on having that with this share, but changed my mind. But while I think I made that choice to shift, I chose to drink water. The truth is, God's omniscient. He knew I was always going to drink water tonight. So how did I exercise my free will if God knew, and God knowledge can only ever be true and correct, God knew I was going to drink water tonight, and therefore when I thought what I perceived as a choice, water, caffeine-free Pepsi, something else, it wasn't actually a choice at all. I'm just simply running along the rails of my life that God's omniscience definitionally dictates I must live by. This is a significant question, and one that there are a whole variety of solutions. I should note, just before we kind of talk about some of the solutions, and again, please God, at some point, maybe we can have a whole series on this question, free will versus determinism, because again, it's its own huge topic. There are some people who think this is the dumbest question and it's nonsense, and they dismiss it. Of course, free will and determinism aren't incompatible with one another. There is a professor at YU, Dr. David Johnson, who is a very, very serious analytical philosopher, and not the most interesting person to ever listen to in the room. And he was so disturbed to learn that another one of the major philosophers he respects is bothered by this question, because he thinks the whole question is nonsense. And then he learned one of his philosophical idols is bothered by the question and had a whole crisis of philosophical faith. But there are people who just don't think this is an issue. But for a lot of other people, this is the question at the heart of free will. So the question is, how do we solve the challenge? How? Because we need it. Because if you look, if the free will defense is going to rely on the existence of free will with an omniscient God, we have to be able to explain how the two can coexist. So one answer will be very familiar because we talked about it last week. And we're not going to read the source inside because, quite frankly, as you will have realized from last week, reading medieval Jewish philosophers, even in English, isn't particularly helpful. But you will remember from last week, if you attended or you listened to the share, the Ralbag does not believe God can see into the future. And that is not a limitation of his omniscience. To be more precise, there are statements with truth values. My name is Mark. That has a truth value of yes or no. The answer is yes. There are other statements that have no truth value whatsoever. Cheese is delicious. God has no opinion on the deliciousness of cheese. That's not a violation of his omniscience that God doesn't have a strong opinion on cheese. What about the statement, I will drink water at my shir tonight? So until about 25 minutes ago, that statement didn't have a truth value. It was unknown. And says the Ralbag, God didn't know whether or not I was going to bring water to my share. But the second I did, unlike everyone else who had to wait to see it on camera, or the people who are listening to the recording who have to wait for this confirmation that I'm drinking water, the second this water bottle, you know, touched this table, God knew I had chosen water. That's God's omniscience. God's omniscience is knowing the correct truth value to every statement that has a truth value. And so you can see why this is a very, very easy solution to the free will omniscience problem. Just as we can solve the problem of evil by claiming God can't see into the future, so too, as that's what we saw last week, so too, if we don't want to go down that route because we think it's too non-traditional, we can solve the omniscience free will problem by claiming God can't see into the future. It's a very elegant answer, but the problem is, as I kind of already said, if you don't like that answer as a solution to the problem of evil, you're not going to like that answer as a solution to the problem of free will and determinism. It's the exact same issue once again raised. But it is nonetheless one way of solving this question. How can we have free will if God knows what we are going to do in advance? Another way of answering the question, and is probably the best known solution to the free will determinism, is to point out that God is actually beyond time. And this is an oft-quoted explanation as to how free will can coexist with God's omniscience. But it requires a little bit more understanding and processing what that means. For God, if God is outside of time, there is no past, present, or future. The whole notion of such concepts, it is completely, he has no way of understanding it. The idea that, you know, earlier today, I was going to drink water tonight during my shir, that's just not a thing God can comprehend. Because God is outside of time. Time has zero relevance to him. And again, don't ask me exactly what this now starts to mean, because we're going to see a source that's kind of going to, you know, cut all of this away. But essentially, concepts such as the future and the past are akin to the deliciousness of cheese for God. they are alien concepts. They are things he cannot understand. And therefore, because God is beyond time, his omniscience doesn't actually interfere with the choices that we make. This is where you might start to feel a need to grab some Advil, because it gets very confusing very quickly. But this is why, and what we have here in source number three is a quote from the Rambam, not about God being beyond time, but a quote that kind of sums up Rambam's general perspective when it comes to trying to think too much about God. Source number three, these subtle notions that very clearly elude the minds cannot be considered through the instrumentality of the customary words, which are the greatest among the causes leading unto error. For the bounds of expression in all languages are very narrow indeed, so that we cannot represent this notion to ourselves except through a certain looseness of expression. What Rambam is saying here is we have no way of talking about God. We don't have the words to do it. We don't have the, we just can't. It's like trying, lahavdil alef havdalot. What is it like to be a dog? You can't do it. There is no way we can anthropomorphize the dog. We can think, we can turn the dog into a human Disney style, but it is impossible. Even babies, like what Kayla, you know, earlier today, like what's going through her mind? I have no way of even comprehending. She's 9 months old. I have no idea what she sees, what she comprehends, if she thinks, all of these things. We have no way of understanding anything beyond our own sense of self and frame of reference. How much more so with God? God is beyond time. He lives in literally a completely different, you know, world to us. And so free will is a distinctly human concept. Omniscience is a distinctly divine concept. We just gave it a word, but we don't really understand it. And so the two don't conflict because the two just exist on different planes. And that's the best way of trying to understand this solution without getting into further details. And quite frankly, at a certain point, without a lot more research, I cannot explain it much better than this. But we can move on to a different solution, to the question of how can we have free will if God knows everything that we are going to do? One way of solving the problem of God knowing what we are going to do with free will is to argue that the two are actually compatible by engaging in a few different really fun thought experiments. And I'm going to give all three because each one is delightful for different reasons. And there will be at least some of you who will find yourself repeating at the Shabbos table at least one of these experiments in the near future because they're really fun. Here goes the first one. This coming Shabbat, you'll be in shul and you want to listen to my drasha. So you sit down in shul. When Howard says, please be seated, you sit down ready to listen. Unbeknownst to you, I've actually arranged with the police officer that when it comes to the time of my drasha, they're going to go in and they're going to stand by the entrance exit to the sanctuary with a taser. And anyone who tries to leave gets tased. You don't, in the actual thought experiment, the door is locked, but I think the image is more entertaining to imagine a police officer with a taser barring anyone from leaving during the rabbi's drasha. But you don't know the police officer is there and you have no desire to leave during the drasha. You want to listen to it. So the question is, did you exercise your free will when sitting to listen in the drasha? You wanted to listen to it. You chose to sit and listen to it. You didn't know that you didn't actually have a choice. There was no other option for you to do anything else. Did you or did you not exercise your free choice? A similar example that's often used in the philosophical literature is, let's say, you know, I can't legally vote, so I've not paid too much attention to people's lawn signs. But let's say Andy is running for Overland Park mayor. I've not seen a sign with his name on, so I'm assuming he's not. But let's just say he was. And you are going into the voting booth and you're going to vote for Andy because you want to vote for Andy. Unbeknownst to you, Andy has struck a deal with some evil scientist to place inside every voting booth a little device emitting some mind-altering whatnot that will make sure you everyone votes for Andy. If you walk in intending to vote for someone else, you'll vote for Andy no matter what because of the mind-controlling device. You walk into that booth, however, always intending to vote for Andy. So did you exercise your free will? Did you exercise your choice or not? You didn't have a choice. You didn't realize you didn't have a choice, but nonetheless, did you exercise your free will or not in choosing to vote for Andy? And a slightly more interesting version of this is, and this is the final one, don't worry. Tomorrow you're feeling a little bit peckish. You'd like a snack. So you walk into the Hy-Vee, you know, gas station. They now have a new name for it, to buy a snack. And then you realize you start patting your pockets. You don't have your phone on you. You don't have a wallet on you. I'm such a 21st century 2021 person. The first source of money I think of is my phone now, and Apple Pay, and not the actual wallet. But you don't have your phone on you. You don't have your wallet on you. You don't have any coins. You don't have any money whatsoever. You actually have a choice. You can steal some food. You can be very subtle, take a chocolate bar, sneak it into your pocket and walk away and happily eat. You can steal the food or you can walk away. But in truth, what does everyone hopefully do? They don't think twice about it. They just walk away. Did you have free will or not in that situation? If there is so much of a social, religious, moral pressure for you to not steal, do you actually have free will or not in a store? And I don't want to, again, this is a whole topic that can be explored in its own right, but it starts to raise, you know, should we get points? It's the famous statement of Chazal, now I think about it, that I think I mentioned in the run-up to Elul. It's better to, you know, want to eat pig but refrain from it because it's forbidden than to have no desire at all. And that would actually fit with the idea that, because if you have no desire to eat pig, you're not exercising your free will. You're not choosing to follow God's law. You're just doing it automatically. But if you have the desire, you're exercising your free will. But the question becomes, can one have free, in any of these three examples I just gave, despite the fact that you actually only have one choice, do you exercise free will? And people would argue, yes, free will and omniscience can be compatible. People can make choices despite the fact that there aren't actually any choices to begin with. The classic version of it, which is often repeated, is, you know, if you offer a child, you know, a chocolate bar and a pickle, of course they're going to choose the chocolate bar, unless it's my child, and then he'll go for the pickle. So, you know, he's the proof that makes this experiment true. But they'll always choose the chocolate because, you know, but they're still exercising a choice, even though you know what they're going to choose. So one other way of solving the problem of, one other way of solving the omniscience free will challenge is to say they can be compatible by appealing to these kinds of thought experiments. It should be noted that none of these examples proves that omniscience and free will are compatible with one another, but they show a path that would, you know, one could go down in order to see that omniscience and free will are compatible. A fourth answer, and there's five answers in total, a fourth different solution to the omniscience free will is, it's a mystery. It's a complete mystery, but it exists nonetheless, which might strike you as it's one of those answers which is either the most profound answer of them all or the worst answer of them all. Different people will have different opinions. And the fifth answer, which is perhaps a slightly different, you know, take on this, is that because free will is a core Jewish belief, it must be that free will exists despite the fact that God is omniscient. How exactly? Don't ask me how it works, but I know it to work, even if I don't understand exactly how. That answer is also a product of the fact that Jewish philosophy isn't as systematic as we might think. But that answer will also start to, you'll also start to notice again the parallels between this question of free will and determinism and God's omniscience and the answers to the problem of evil just as the problem of evil has the anti-theodicy, throw your hands up, it must work, I just don't understand how, the question of God's free will and God, our free will and God's omniscience, also one of the answers is to just throw your hands up and say, I don't know how it works, but it does. But regardless, for our purposes, that whistle-stop tour of the various approaches to the question of God's omniscience and free will, how can we have free will when God knows what we are going to do, did essentially one of two things. Either one of those answers is, in and of itself, sufficient in order to satisfy the problem, or alternatively, you know, to use halachic language, it gives us a svek-sveka. The whole question might not be a question to begin with, but if it is a question, there are a whole variety of solutions to the problem. For our purpose, we need to know that there is a potential challenge in including both omniscience and free will in the same orbit, but it is solvable. There are solutions out there, and so the free will defense can go on. It has a level of legitimacy to it that we don't need to worry about the incompatibility of free will and omniscience. And so if you've, you know, spent the last 10 minutes completely lost by everything that was saying, or the migraine at this point is really strong and you can't go on for much longer, we can pause to just say the free will defense is still working at this point on a technical level. Everything about the question we just posed, omniscience versus free will, was a technical challenge to the problem of evil, but a necessary challenge that needs to be, if not solved, then at least acknowledged is solvable. That's what we just did. There is, however, a third challenge to the problem of evil, to the free will defense. Okay. If a thief breaks into your house, you can maybe make peace with the fact that God doesn't want to take away the thief's free will. What about an earthquake or a flood? When there is no human involvement whatsoever, we've not actually really touched on this aspect of the problem of evil until now, but the problem of evil, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking it always involves human agency. Sometimes it doesn't. There are earthquakes, there are floods, there are natural disasters, which don't seem to contravene anyone's free will. If God were to stop earthquakes from happening or to stop dams from breaking, that doesn't contravene anyone's free will. Sure, the free will defense explains for now, that we'll come to in a second, how far we can take it, but the problem of evil explains human causes of evil, but it doesn't explain natural disaster. It doesn't necessarily explain disease. It doesn't explain a whole host of things. So this is a very powerful challenge, but the simplest solution is to basically point out that free will is but one of the greater values that God, you know, places above the existence of evil. Another one of which is the natural functioning of the world. God sets up the world to run by a series of laws of physics, laws of nature, yada, yada, yada. And what that means is, you know, tectonic plates are going to crash into one another and results are going to follow. Things, you know, it is the nature of the world that unfortunately these natural disasters will happen. Tornadoes are not unnatural. They are very much a natural part of the world. And so God sets up the world to run in a certain way. And therefore, he does not intervene. Again, it's important for the world to run according to nature. We don't want the lightning bolts raining down randomly. We want the world to be natural and ordered. And so it's not actually just free will, but there are a whole list of things that need to function in this world that God does not get in the way of. related to this entire idea is an important distinction to be made between what's termed God's transcendence and his immanence. I feel indefinitely in some other context, at least once I have touched on this. It could have been a Tuesday night share. It could have been some other format. But take a look at source number 4. Again, this is Rambam who says, on the one hand, there is a demonstration of his separateness, may he be exalted, from the world and of his being free from it. And on the other hand, there is a demonstration that the influence of his governance and providence in every part of the world. God's transcendence is the belief. Where is God? He's all the way up there. He listens to our prayers. He may answer them with a yes. He may intervene. But fundamentally, he doesn't intervene too extremely. And he sits, he proverbially sits, and allows the world to function according to the rules that he set it up by. God's immanence, and if you've ever heard the song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, up, down, all around, the idea that God is literally right here, right now, almost sat next to me, as it were, that's God's immanence. And the idea that God directly influences every aspect of the world, you get an itch, you have to scratch your finger. That was actually God tickling your finger. The idea that we are, but, you know, pieces on the chessboard and God is moving us all around. That's a divine immanence mentality. But if you believe in a mainly transcendent God, then it makes sense that he is going to rarely intervene in the world. God's transcendence is another value that is important for God to maintain most of the time. And therefore, generally speaking, that he will not prevent evil if it forces him to violate his transcendence, just as he will not prevent evil, which forces him to, you know, prevent humans from exercising their free will. This is the free will defense. Essentially, it's the greater good defense. It is that God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. And ultimately, he will allow evil to exist. He will allow evil to happen in order to allow other benefits that perhaps we might not even notice at the time, but nonetheless, other benefits that we enjoy, for them to flourish. Nonetheless, so before I say my nonetheless, actually, when it comes to analyzing the legitimacy of the free will defense, so as you probably got the idea, it rests on a lot of philosophical assumptions. There is a large philosophical structure you need to build, of which many parts of that structure can be questioned, can be challenged, but are nonetheless, we've not said anything controversial, philosophically speaking. We've not said anything outlandish or crazy, even if we've not said everything that's universally accepted. The free will defense rests on a lot of philosophical assumptions, but they are fundamentally valid ones, especially when we think of the fact that it is a defense. It's not a definitive answer, but again, to go back to the court analogy, in order to cast, you know, doubt in the minds of the jurors that premise one and premise two are the ultimate contradiction that leads us gives us a problem. No, the free will defense casts some doubt into our minds. Maybe as correct as premise one and premise two are, maybe it is true. There does seem to be a good argument to be made that there are other values we would want to be preserved in this world that would have to be erased in order to prevent evil from flourishing. It gives a plausible explanation of why evil would exist, why God would permit evil to happen, rather than being its explicit cause, but nonetheless permit evil to happen. And it gives an explanation as to how. It doesn't create the same theological turmoil some of the other answers do, even if it still creates some, you know, theological head scratching. It's not as crazy as the anti, as the non-traditional response. It's not as unsatisfying as the anti-theodicy, and it's not as disappointing as the traditional theodicy. It's a pretty good answer. But it does face a major, major challenge. Because until now, I have been trying to remain very intentional with my examples. So the thief example. Someone breaks into your home, you know, steals a few things, everyone's fine, it sucks. But the idea that God would not want to violate the thief's free will makes sense. What about if we dial up the evil a little bit more extreme? Huge acts of evil. A tsunami. That's actually not do natural disasters. Something as, you know, horrific as a pandemic sweeping through the world, you know, destroying most of what we know. Or obviously, as I'd given the trigger warning at the very first year, but the Holocaust. You're telling me that in order to allow humans to preserve free will, that the Nazis had to be allowed to kill 6 million Jews? Like, seriously? That's what the free will defense is claiming. It's not as bad as the theodicies, which is blaming someone for that. But nonetheless, and it's not perhaps as bad as the non-traditional response, which was saying God could do nothing. What the free will defense is claiming, seemingly, is that it was so important for humans to have free will that the Nazis had to be allowed to exercise the extremes of their free will. And so you can rewrite the problem of evil that takes the challenges of, that takes the response of the free will defense and kind of pumps it back in, and you're still left with the problem of evil. Take a look at source number 5. So now this is the problem, the new problem of evil. An omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God exists that would prevent evil unless he could not do so without sacrificing a greater good or allowing a greater evil. That's the free will defense. God does not want to. He would prevent evil if he didn't have to stomp out humanity's free will. So he lets evil sometimes slide. However, premise 2, evil or bad things exist that could be prevented by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God without sacrificing a greater good or allowing a greater evil. In other words, there is gratuitous suffering. Surely there is a point where God has to turn around and say that the evil being created is now worse than the good that's trying to be preserved. Surely it would be. It would have been very nice if, and the words I'm about to use are very intentional given the answer I'm about to provide, if at some point during the Holocaust, God would have been like, well, enough is enough. I'm going to, you know, let's get rid of free will at this point. Would have made sense. Gratuitous suffering happens a lot. And if the free will defense claims that God allows evil in order to allow us to have free will, surely there is a lie. But the response to that is, where is that lie? And there are basically two solutions to this problem, which I think are independently fascinating, philosophically speaking, but very fascinating when it comes to also solving this new version of the problem of evil. The first answer would be to claim that this new version of the problem of evil is basically asking for an arbitrary line to be drawn in the sand. So to take one of my favorite philosophical ideas, Sorites' paradox, which is there are a few different ways of stating it, but you know, if I were to right now pluck a hair from my head, no one would ever call me bald. If I were to keep on doing that, eventually I would be bald. but there is no one single hair that were I to pull from my head, that would be the watershed moment. That's not how these things work. It's very rarely. It's also the issue of it's the issue of vagueness. There is not one official height where anyone who is above that is tall, anyone who is below that is short. There is not, if you're trying to lose weight, there is not one single pound that when lost marks the official transition from, to having lost weight, gaining weight, same. That's why it's so easy to gain weight, because it's just, 1 pound isn't a big deal, but before you know it, it's 10. But the challenge is, as powerful and a response as this is to the free will defense, there is no way of arguing for a non-arbitrary line to be drawn in the sand. And trigger warning, because very distressing thought experiment incoming, but the free will defense hinges on the idea that for God to have stopped the Nazis before they started being Nazis would have been a violation of free will. That is essentially part of the free will defense. At which point would you confidently say is a good dividing line for God to stop? There is not. Obviously, it goes without saying that if, only the way I phrase it already kind of gets to the problem. If there'd only been 1 million Jews died rather than 6 million, that would have been a lot better. Unquestionably so. But it's still 1 million. How could we ever turn around and say a 1 million would be enough? That's nonsense. There is not the problem is once you accept humans need free will, there is no non-arbitrary line in the sand you can draw. And it's the same with, again, when we think of a slightly lighter example, and only because of the previous example is so horrific, diseases in this world. There is no one disease, even though we just, in the past year and a half have learned of a new one, there is no one single disease that if it were to be removed right now by God miraculously, the world would be a better place. You know how we know that? Because 18 months ago before COVID, we weren't all dancing around, in fields of daisies holding hands saying the world is a great, amazing place. It still sucked. Because, it didn't. It was, the world, we should always appreciate living in this world. But there were still a ton of diseases that afflicted us all a whole variety of times. And humanity, to a certain extent, still seemed unbearable a year and a half ago. We were just more used to coping with some of those diseases. But no one, if COVID disappeared tonight, there would be a few weeks of joy before we started to realize all the other things that afflict humanity. And this is essentially the challenge to this new version of the problem of evil. It is impossible to draw a non-arbitrary line that doesn't cut, again, the greater value of free will or some of these other greater values. It's impossible. It can't be done. And that's one response. There's no way of doing so. The alternative response, and this is where this is the most moment. This is the most Jewish mind logic ever incoming. If there is one being that knows the non-arbitrary cutoff line, it's an omniscient deity. And it is the very fact of God's omniscience that allows this world to function at the very edge of acceptable evil. And what we don't realize is that God is continually preventing evils from existing that would wipe out humanity, that would wipe out the Jewish people, that would destroy us. COVID was allowed because humanity can respond. But some other mysterious disease was destroyed before it ever got to humanity because that would have wiped us all out. And that is what being an omniscient deity is. And there's a very I would say, relatively well-known, oft-quoted statement of it's the Zohar to the beginning of Parashat Yitro, which is a very famous Pesach idea. The why did God wait 210 years to redeem the Jewish people from slavery? They were slaves. They were being tortured. They were being miserable. Why not do it after 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 70 years, 100 years? Why 210 years? It seems an entirely arbitrary number and a gratuitously long amount of time to allow multiple generations to live in torturous slavery. Says the Zohar, what happened? After each and every however long, the Jewish people would slip further and further down the scale of tumah, the scale of impurity. Don't really ask me what that means. I'm not a Zohar guy. But the idea is well known. And the Jewish people had reached, by year 210, the Jewish people had reached such a low level that one more descent would have been the point at which there would be no return. In other words, God only intervened at the precise moment after which the Jewish people would have been unredeemable. Now, this still raises, I'm not going to pretend this doesn't raise a lot of other theological questions. This is part of the problem with the philosophical problem of evil, is it doesn't actually stop the harrowing. It doesn't actually make the harrowing questions go away. It's just a very clever response. But God's redemption of us from Egypt is the free will, is the response to the challenge to the free will defense. God allowed the, and there's the whole, we're not going to get into that whole question of, does God remove Pharaoh's free will? And let's not get into that, but let's just kind of ignore all of that stuff. But essentially, God allowed the Egyptians to exercise their free will until the point at which he decided enough is enough. God is the only being that knows the non-arbitrary cutoff, and he acts on it. And we don't appreciate it. We don't realize it because we live in the world with all the other horrible things still existing that we don't, and we cannot comprehend the things that don't exist. But it is, you know, God who is actually intervening at the non, or everything we get. And I hate, I'll just state for the record, I hate the phrase, you know, God doesn't give you a challenge you can't overcome, because if it is a powerful phrase for you, more power to you. And definitely it's good when, again, you walk into a bench and you're like, I'm hurt. But like, I don't like it as an answer to like major issues. But as much as I don't like it, that's essentially this response here. That God stops anything from get any evil that humanity would not be able to cope with. He allows evil through that will preserve free will, that will preserve these other values, but cuts off anything that free will is more important than evil. But once the evil gets risks going above the free will, at that point, that's when he cuts it off. That's the response. That's the free will defense. This is, and there's a little bit more I do want to share that's very, very important. But to kind of wrap up the philosophical portion of everything we've been discussing, there is a free will defense to the problem of evil. Yes, an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent deity should stop evil and definitely can stop evil, but won't, because ultimately there is no, this is a theological vacuum, and that's not how theology actually works. And we need free will. We need things to go according to, you know, we need the world to function the way it's supposed to function. We need the laws of physics. We need the laws of this. We need this. We need that. And therefore, God will not intervene unless evil risks overwhelming one of those other values. This need not be a neat and tidy answer, but it is a defense. It's enough, I think, of a philosophically strong argument to question, not to answer, but to question the validity of the problem of evil. But I do want to read one more source, Because until now, we've been talking about the problem of evil, and as I said at the beginning, the philosophical problem. But as I said, there is an alternative problem of evil, which is the personal problem of evil. And more significantly, what we see is that regardless of how we account for the existence of evil in the world, it is undeniable that there is evil in this world. And so I'd always intended to put these sources on, but it's particularly pertinent given it this, you know, today was the Yahrzeit of the first Yahrzeit of Lord Sacks, who has, it's a long quote, as you'll see as I'm scrolling, but I do want to read it because it's incredibly powerful. And two different statements from two different books, which we have here in source number 6, which I think just perfectly encapsulate the most important takeaway from this series, despite the fact that we've been talking about everything but this. Lord Sacks writes the following in source number 6. There is a difference between a contradiction and a cry. You can solve a contradiction by sitting quietly in a room, thinking, using conceptual ingenuity, reframing. You cannot solve a cry by thinking. Moses, weeping for his people, is not consoled by Leibniz's admittedly brilliant proof that all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Theodicy, solving the problem of evil. The attempt to vindicate God's justice in a world of evil is compelling evidence that in the translation of Abrahamic spirituality in the language of Plato and Aristotle, something is lost. What is lost is the cry. The free will to kind of pause and then read the next quote. Very, you know, it's also just brilliant writing and incredibly powerful and dramatic. But the free will defense is an amazing defense to the problem of evil. But if, you know, you're walking down the street tomorrow and you see someone trip and fall and your first thought is, well, you know, God wants, you know, humans to function the way they do. And so, you know, they trip and okay, that is just, that's the way God intended the world. Then you miss the point. If your neighbor is robbed and you don't knock on to help because you've consoled yourself with the problem of evil, with the solutions, something's gone wrong. And Lord Sacks in To Heal a Fractured World says a slightly different but also important set of statements to read. God exists, therefore there is justice. But it is divine justice. Justice from the perspective of one who knows all, sees all, and considers all. But we who live in space and time cannot see from this perspective. And if we did, it would not make us better human beings, but worse. If we were able to see how evil today leads to good tomorrow, if we were able to see from the point of view of God, creator of all, we would understand justice, but at the cost of ceasing to be human. There is divine justice, and sometimes looking back at the past from a distance in time, we can see it. But we do not live by looking back at the past. God creates divine justice, but only we can create human justice. God did not create humankind to demand of it absolute submission to his all-powerful will. In Revelation, creation speaks. What it says is a call to responsibility. And this statement too, and as you, as I read that, you will have noticed that in like a couple of sentences, and I'm going to stop the screen share at this point, in a couple of sentences, Lord Sacks literally runs through everything we've talked about. And dismisses not their validity, not their importance. Lord Sacks was a rabbi and a philosopher. He understood the importance of having responses to the problem of evil. But he also realized something we all need to realize. Solving the problem of evil is a fascinating theological exercise. And as I said in the opening to the series, it allows us to get a glimpse into some of the chachma, the wisdom of various rabbinic philosophers. It allows us to see the philosophical depth, the theological depth that Judaism has. It does. Sometimes Judaism is portrayed as a very simple, infantile religion, and exploring different responses to the problem of evil disabuses us of that notion. So it's really important to study and understand and grapple with the problem of evil. But no solution to the problem of evil allows us to not attempt to redress the evil in this world. And so, again, what is lost is the cry. What we cannot lose in attempting to solve the problem of evil is hearing the cry of those suffering. And so, as much as this series, I love talking about the problem of evil. It is one of my favorite philosophical topics. I cannot tell you for how long I have been fascinated and obsessed with it, but it can't desensitize us to the actual evil that exists out there. As I've said before, I'm not necessarily the best resource for answering how to redress the evil. But what I can say is we have to try and do something. And so I'd encourage everyone who's attended this series to make a minimal commitment over the next few weeks. You know, we've had 3 weeks of learning about the problem of evil. And so to, you know, at one point over the next 3 weeks, you know, three times over the next 3 weeks, do something to try and redress the evil in this world. Whether it's a small donation or a large donation to a tzedakah, to a charity that helps, you know, really tackle some sort of, you know, evil in existence. Whether it's, again, don't ask me for other examples. I'm not very good at examples other than I always just say donate to a soup kitchen, because I feel like people starving around us is something we can relatively, big word, relatively easily redress and probably should. But we should do something to not allow these various solutions to the problem of evil to deafen us to the cry of those in need. And it's really important that we all not just take the various chachma, the various wisdom that Judaism has offered in answering this theological challenge, but we also take the charge, the call to responsibility to try and redress the evil in this world in whatever way we can.